10 and live on BBC Radio 4 Longwave and Digital Radio, it's time for the Daily Service, which is led by Nigel Swinford. Our Book of the Week now continues Andrew Wilson's new biography of the early life of American writer Sylvia Plath. The 19-year-old Plath is now a student at Smith College, an elite women-only university in Northampton, Massachusetts. But she continues to struggle with the gender inequalities of 1950s America. Hayley Atwell reads Mad Girl's Love Song by Andrew Wilson. Sylvia Plath's words are read by Sasha Pick.
In February 1951, Dick Norton, the elder brother of her friend Perry, wrote to Sylvia to invite her to visit him at Yale for the weekend. On their first weekend together, Sylvia and Dick spent a great deal of time talking in his room. Sylvia felt rather overawed by Dick's scientific approach to life. According to his worldview, only things that could be measured, analysed, or cut open had any value. He had already secured a place at Harvard Medical School for the next academic year and seemed incredibly worldly and grown up. It was, she wrote to a friend, a shame that he hadn't kissed her once, not even in a friendly manner, over the weekend. She had high hopes for their next date, as he had invited her to the Yale Junior Prom in March. Turning to her friends at Smith, she managed to borrow a mouton fur coat, a black leather handbag, a crinoline, and a pair of silver sandals. After the dance, Dick accompanied her to her boarding house, and as the couple walked hand in hand through the deserted streets, the icy wind whipping about their heads, Sylvia felt like she was living a moment that seemed crystalline in its brilliance. Dick kissed her, and then, without saying anything, Sylvia went inside the house.
Still, the blood and flesh of me were electric and singing quietly,
she wrote in her journal. As she fell asleep,
the seeds of awakening and life slumbered there in the dark.
During the spring of 1951, Sylvia could not have found two men more different than Dick Norton, the sensible, conventionally minded Yale student, and her long-distance pen friend and confidant, Eddie Cohen, with his greased back hair, denims, leather jacket, and a cigarette or pipe permanently hanging from his mouth. What especially fascinated and thrilled Sylvia was the contrast between their letters, documents that would often arrive on the same day. On the 18th of March, Dick wrote to her about his loathing for the work of Ernest Hemingway, who wrote material that he regarded as degenerate. The next day, Eddie reflected on the nature and power of their correspondence. After all, it was Sylvia's writing that had first attracted him to her.
What peculiar force was there which caused me to sense the essence of your being by reading a few lines in a magazine, and which sends the blood pounding behind my eyes every time I receive a letter from you?
On the last day before spring break, Sylvia was in her room when a girl called to tell her that there was a boy downstairs waiting to see her. Dick was spending the vacation in Florida, travelling with his grandparents. The figure standing at the bottom of the stairs with a pipe gripped between his teeth was Eddie, who had driven from Chicago to Northampton on a whim.
"This is the third dimension,"
he said, referring to the fact that previously they had only known each other through the two-dimensional form of the letter. Eddie offered to drive her home, and Sylvia was too shocked to refuse. From the beginning, the encounter was an awkward one, as Sylvia felt on edge and nervous, and Eddie, despite his rebellious image, somewhat timid and shy. As the three-hour car journey progressed, Sylvia became increasingly worried about what her mother would say if she saw her daughter with the rather louche-looking Eddie. To try to put him off, she told him that she was in love with a young man from home. Then, on arriving at Elmwood Road, she thanked him in a rather cold manner for the lift and dashed upstairs to her room. Eddie had no option but to turn around and make the 30-hour trip back to Chicago. Inside the Plath household, Aurelia gave Sylvia a stern talking to about her selfish behaviour. Eddie later told Sylvia that the rejection could have prompted him to behave in a rather different manner had the long drive not sapped him of all his energies.
Your mother was quite right. You were incredibly rude. I was no end angry at the reception I received. The incident could have been much different, nastier, perhaps, had my physical condition at the time been different from what it was.
Whereas Dick was unable or unwilling to look into Sylvia's dark heart, Eddie Cohen was only too capable of seeing what lurked behind the young woman's polite and controlled exterior. After the appearance of her short story, Den of Lions, in the May issue of 17, Dick wrote to congratulate her on the use of similes. Eddie, meanwhile, questioned their validity.
A girl trying to decide about a boy does not make similes in her mind about Christmas tree ornaments. I actually find myself wishing at times that some guy comes along, the one who looks like the right one, and then in the end steps on you so hard that you ache for months afterwards, down where I don't think you've ever really hurt.
Sylvia wrote back to tell him that she was not in love with Dick. In fact, she did not believe in the word, an opinion that prompted a furious invective back from Eddie.
Read this first.
He wrote in red, warning her that the enclosed letter was vicious. Cohen couldn't believe that she was so self-centered as not to allow someone to get close to her. Rather, what he suspected was that she was
unwilling to surrender completely because of the emotional damage which would result from failure after that surrender. The philosophy would seem to be that if you don't wade in too deep, you can't possibly drown, which is true enough, but you can't get to the other side either.
Sylvia used her journal to try to analyze her feelings. But as she did so, the old anger about gender inequalities, particularly relating to sexual behavior, began to rise to the surface. Why was it the case that women had to serve so many functions? The receptacle of emotions, the carer of children, the provider of solace. All she wanted to do was to delve into the souls and experiences of those around her, and yet there was a section of the world that was barred from her view. At the end of the entry, she wrote,
"Being born a woman is my awful tragedy."
From Harvard, Dick Norton wrote Sylvia a series of loving but strange letters. He called her my girl and princess, praised her as a dear, sweet, lovable and beautiful woman, and longed to hold her close, yet sent her a number of detailed anatomical drawings of a cadaver that he was dissecting. She visited him several times at Harvard Medical School, where she saw dead babies in glass bottles, and accompanied him to anatomy lessons where she witnessed a dissection of a cadaver.
For weeks afterwards, the cadaver's head, or what there was left of it, floating up behind my eggs and bacon at breakfast.
Sylvia continually tried to expand the limits of her poetic technique. In November 1951, no doubt inspired by one of her visits down to Harvard to see Dick Norton, she wrote a sonnet that expressed the enormous gap between the young couple's personal ideologies. Whereas men like Dick thought that it was possible to dissect a skull the way one would take apart a clock, viewing its individual components as a
mute geometry of broken cogs and discs,
women like Sylvia believed that it was impossible to reduce everything to the scientific. She likened the mind to
a collection of minute mechanisms, trivial and smooth functioning when in operation, but absurd and disjointed when taken apart.
After sitting her end-of-year exams, Sylvia travelled down to Cape Cod, where she had secured a job at the Belmont. Initially, the concept of a summer working at the hotel in West Harwich thrilled her. Not only would she be near Dick, but she also hoped that she would earn lots of money to help pay her expenses for the following year at Smith. She discovered that because she had no waitressing experience, she would not be working in the main dining hall after all, and, as a result, would lose out on potentially lucrative tips. Her day started at 8 in the morning, and her duties, washing dishes, cleaning silver, lifting furniture, scrubbing tables, left her irritable and depressed.
"I was beginning to worry about money when your telegram came,"
she told her mother, referring to the news that she had won a $500 prize from Mademoiselle magazine for her story Sunday at the Mintons. Although the telegram lifted her spirits for a moment, when she heard the news, she flung her arms around the head waitress. The sight of a mass of beautiful, confident girls who worked in the main hall left her feeling jealous and insecure. She wrote to her mother,
"As for me, being the conservative, quiet, gracious type, I don't stand much chance of dating some of the cutest guys."
Sylvia's mental vulnerability expressed itself by the onset of physical illness. One Saturday at the end of June, she started to suffer a sore throat, a usual indicator that she was coming down with an attack of sinusitis. The next day, she felt so ill that she had to be injected with penicillin, a course of treatment that continued for 3 days. When her boss from the Belmont telephoned to ask when she would be returning to her job, Aurelia told him that Sylvia was probably too ill to return, a story conjured up between mother and daughter, and that it would be better if they started to look for someone else. Although Sylvia felt an immediate sense of relief, within a matter of days, she began to suffer from another depression brought on by the fact that she missed her old job. She compared the feeling to being hit over the head by a nasty blackjack. She felt released from the depression only when she received a package of forwarded letters, including one from Harold Strauss, the editor-in-chief at Knopf. Cyrilly Abels, the managing editor of Mademoiselle magazine, had forwarded him the advance proofs of Plath's story Sunday at the Mintons, and he wrote to say how impressed he was with her work.
"This struck me as an extraordinarily deft and mature story, far better than the average prize-winning short story."
He added that he would be interested in reading a novel by her, if she ever felt so inclined to write one. Back at home, with nothing to do but sunbathe and read, she felt at a loss about how to fill her time. The contrast between the two worlds, the stimulating ambience of the Belmont with its clearly demarcated schedule and the sluggish, routineless environs of Elmwood Road, made her think that someone had lifted off a bell jar from a vessel that contained a functioning community to reveal
poor, frightened people, flailing, impotent arms in the aimless air. What to do? Where to turn as I hang suspended in the strange thin air of back home?
On the 25th of July, a fortnight after she had first written about the concept of the bell jar in the journal, Sylvia revived the concept again in a letter to a friend, Marcia. She talked about how, for most of her life, she had felt contained in a bell jar. She had a schedule mapped out for her at college, certain goals she wanted to achieve, never having more than 2 or 3 weeks' time when she had to think for herself. As she told Marcia, although she had experienced the sudden removal of the lid of her own bell jar when she had left the Belmont never to return, she hoped that soon she would settle back into her own routine.
"I long only too soon to be myself, whatever that is, again."
And tomorrow, Sylvia Plath's mental fragility is tested by a summer in New York. Hayley Atwell was reading from Mad Girl's Love Song by Andrew Wilson. Sylvia Plath was played by Sasha Pick and Eddie Cohen by Ben Crow. The book was abridged by Miranda Davis and produced by Emma Harding. Coming up after the news, Jenny Murray with Woman's Hour.
Hello there, I'm Justin Edwards and I'm here to tell you all about the new series of Newsjack. But because Newsjack is a topical sketch show made especially for 4Extra, there isn't really much to say at the moment. Fear not though, our crack team are trained to spot the super stories in whatever guise they take, from shocking celebrity behaviour and powerful political decisions to an elderly lady trying to restore a priceless painting and a man trying to wheel his bike through a gate.
Newsjack, brand new topical comedy over on BBC Radio 4 Extra. Thursday nights at 10:30.
And you can hear highlights from the last series in Newsjack Revisited here on BBC Radio 4 tonight at 11:00.